are friends with Fantasy Benefits.
Mike, how hard are you right now?
Oh, man, I've been hard since you said, hi, welcome to Friends with Fantasy Benefits podcast.
I mean, maybe you're going to end up with a great team if it works out that way. But otherwise, I think you're going to be left probably having to wheel and deal quite a bit in the season. And that's not happening in your NFBC drafts because you can't trade.
We are Friends with Fantasy Benefits.
I am with the unofficial doctor of FWFB, that is Andrew Dr. Dewhurst. How are you today, Andrew?
We are Friends with Fantasy Benefits.
Welcome, everyone, to a Friends with Fantasy Benefits podcast. I am Chuck Anderson. I am with the unofficial doctor of FWFB, that is Andrew Dr. Dewhurst. How are you today, Andrew?
Doing great, Chuck. How are you doing today?
I'm wonderful as well. That's so funny because Andrew just told me that his day actually hasn't gone very well to this point, but he's putting on his game face, which I strongly appreciate. Where can you be reached on Twitter, my friend?
You can find me at Andrew K. Dewhurst.
Anyway, I am Chuck Anderson, and I can be reached at Just Chucking It on Twitter. And I have never before done four slow drafts simultaneously, and I literally feel like I could shove a finger through my own eye right now. I'm just trying to balance all the things that the teams need at once is a little bit crazy. What's the most drafts you've done at one time before, Andrew? Do you know?
As far as slow drafts go, I'm only at two going right now. I think that's about the most, maybe two or three at once. But yeah, it can be tough to keep straight.
And I'm only a few days away from the TGFBI, right?
Yeah, 2 weeks. Well, yeah, I guess less than that, right? Next week, March 1st.
Yikes. Anyway, hopefully one of my slow drafts will be done by then so I can keep some sanity. But anyway, we did manage to come up with a concept for you guys today, and I really think it's an interesting one. I want to know what you actually think about, what actually goes through your mind when you make your first five picks. Then we're going to talk about what goes through your mind when you make your second five picks. Then I've prepared a list of players that I'm presuming will sort of be out of the normal game plans, but are going, interestingly enough in comparison to these concepts of how people generally draft. So I will be the first to admit that I've been a little lost this year so far, trying to figure out exactly how I wanted to draft my teams. If I wanted them to be, I had a base game plan and I'm trying to draft around that game plan. And then, of course, I'm getting some change-ups because drafts don't go exactly how you think they're going to go, etc. But I'm very excited. Oh, I was told on Twitter this week that I should be called Mr. etc. So I need to try and cut that out of my vocabulary. But anyway, I am very interested in what Andrew Dewhurst has to say about what he thinks about while making his first five picks in a draft.
Yeah, for me, it's all about sticking to the game plan. Whether that be mean that you're going to try to get as much power as you can early, or you're going to try to go to two aces, whatever that might be. I think it's really, for the first five, it's got to be about that, right? I mean, there's all kinds of hyperbole out there of, you know, you're not going to win your league in your draft, but you sure can lose it. And I think that's definitely rings true in the first five rounds. I think we've seen lots of information about, you know, that you only have about 50% chance of your first pick actually returning first pick value. But I think a lot of that stuff is, you know, it's interesting, but it shouldn't really bother you on draft day. For me personally, I'm trying to shoot for balance. So, you know, I'd love to, you know, I want to get an ace. And after that, I want guys that are going to give me five category contribution. Exactly who those guys doesn't necessarily matter. But a lot of it goes into your prep and knowing who you're targeting. And for me, I think it's really important to stay true to that and not say, you know, in those first five, well, you know, this guy's got a lot of power. Let's just jump at that power instead, because I think what you're going to find is that when you hit the back half of the draft, that you're not going to end up necessarily where you hope to be.
You know, I do think that's a very interesting concept. And one of the things that happened, one of the reasons that I've struggled a little bit, I haven't been as excited about some of my draft results as I wanted to be early on this draft season, is because the KDS system hasn't been very fair to me in my NFBC leagues, meaning I got my 11th choice, pick 12 in the most recent one that I was in. And the random drafts have had me in spots that I really didn't want to be. Either the I consider the no man's land between seven and nine, or I've been late in the drafts. So I haven't really been able to know exactly how things were going to fall. In the one draft where I drafted pick 12, I thought it was pretty absurd that Bryce Harper fell to me at 12. I literally had my mind set that I was going to be unhappy with what was left to me, and I was thinking about taking Machado to sort of get some positional flexibility and get some middle infield spots out of the way. And instead, when Harper fell to me, I switched to Harper. And then, like you said, I mean, since I didn't stick to my game plan because of what I thought the value was, then I sort of had to go makeshift from there, which has been interesting in and of itself. But I was curious if you were going to be that straight line in what you thought your actual plan was, or if you were going to take some player values into account and then maybe have go to a backup plan, or decide that you were going to just sort of fly by the seat of your pants to get a player value that you perceived to be far greater than what you thought was going to be available to you. I had Bryce Harper going off the board in the top six picks no matter what. And the other scenario I want to give to you in this case, that I want to talk to you about how you so eloquently spoke your base strategy in the first five rounds to me, is if you were to lose in KDS and you got to pick eight or pick nine and Nolan Arenado was available to you, since you seem to be searching for so much balance, does that mean that you would pass on Arenado to keep your game plan for the balance, or do you think you would go to a plan B?
Well, I think what you have to consider at that moment in time is, if you're going to take Arenado, how are you going to balance him with steals? Which I think means you're going to have to do one of two things. You're going to have to probably take B. Gordon in the second. Like, you're going to have to start reaching around ahead for either D. Gordon or Billy Hamilton, because those are the only two guys you can guarantee are going to offer you the balance. And preferably, I mean, you want D. Gordon because he's only going to hurt you in home runs, as opposed to Billy Hamilton, who's also going to hurt you in average. But that's how I see it, is like, you can – I mean, my preference, actually, if that was the case, is I would probably just move to an ace at that point instead of trying to grab a hitter. If it's, you know, if my plan is I want five category contributor and that's not there, then go and grab a pitcher. But I mean, that's the way I see it. And I mean, when I'm building my rankings and I'm building my strategy, I'm thinking about my guys, and I need to understand who my guys are and when they're going to be available. So, I mean, I'm not a fan of flying by the seat of your pants. And sometimes I think if you're not prepared and you're going into your draft saying, I'm just going to take the best player available all the time, then I think you're going to find – I mean, maybe you're going to end up with a great team if it works out that way. But otherwise, I think you're going to be left probably having to wheel and deal quite a bit in the season. And that's not happening in your NFBC drafts, because you can't trade.
Well, I will say this. There's one factor that I thought we were going to get to, and unfortunately, Justin Mason is sick. So I think he would be the guy that would be the proponent of this. But one of the things that I see people do instead of the game plan situation is they say to themselves, for the first five rounds, I'm going to take whoever I think the best player available is. Period. And then I'm going to adjust from there. You hear people say positional flexibility, et cetera, is – oh, I said et cetera again. Positional flexibility is overrated, and to some extent, I'm certain that it is. I also think, you know, I want to portray these first five rounds to our listeners in view of exactly what my base formula was going into drafts this year. My base formula was that I thought I could wait on first base, and I thought I could wait at shortstop. Those are the two positions that I thought I could wait on. What I've learned through the draft season is that I like second base even less than I thought I did, and I didn't really like it very much to begin with. I was going to position myself to try and get Altuve, but the KDS was not very nice to me, so that hasn't happened. But I really dislike second base, and I would much rather wait at shortstop and wait at first base. And there is some bombs out there. There's a minefield on how to do that. I also said I was going to hedge my bets and go with some of the first base outfield types, the Reese Hoskins, the Bellingers,
Ian Desmonds.
Ian Desmonds, the Will Myers now, since we know he's going to be outfield eligible very soon. So that was my base game plan, and the KDS sort of made it a little trickier on me than what I thought it was going to be to do that. So, and I was like you. I want to get an ace as well. So I take it you are not and have not been a proponent of just taking whoever you think the best player is for the first five rounds. Have you done that in the past?
I have done that in the past, and I think – it's not a terrible strategy, right? It just forces you to think a lot more on your feet. And to be even more prepared. So, like, I think that's easier to do in leagues where you're drafting face to face, because you probably know the room and you know a little bit more about how each person tends to draft, so you can work around that a little bit more. But I think in bigger leagues where you don't know anybody, I think like it really forces you to think on your feet quite a bit and to know their player pool and to do some more tracking. And I mean, there's nothing wrong with any of that. Like, if you have the time and you've got an understanding of, you know, you're tracking expected stats and you're saying, okay, this is what I've got through five, and you know, putting up the red flags where you've got holes and you're below where you're expecting to be, then I think it's a perfectly fine way to go, and maybe it's probably the way to go. But for me personally, while I have done a significant amount of draft preparation this year, I just haven't prepared myself in that way.
Okay, I want to go through some of our players on our player list now that I perceive as being top five round players. And I want to mention to you why I put them on the player list versus our concept, which of course in this case is going to mean that I find them to be outliers of sorts. When you said that you knew that you were going to get steals, you were putting this first guy up on a tee for us, because the guy that I chose to make up for steals in the league where I drafted Harper at 12 is Byron Buxton. And Byron Buxton is, to me, the ultimate upside gamble, in so much as if everything falls right, I don't think people would be surprised if he hit 24 to 27 home runs and stole 50 plus bases. But if everything goes wrong, he could get sent back down to the minors again. And we're going off a guy who has some limited stints of being very good. But when he's been very good, he's been really, really good. So what are your thoughts on Byron Buxton?
So I agree. Like, I think, like, Buxton's projected to be at least a 2020 guy. I don't think there's much chance of him getting sent down to the minors because his defense is so good. So there's some stability in that. I don't love necessarily the 50, like his ADP right now is at 52, and Roster Resource has him batting six. So those two things, if in fact that's his true batting spot, don't add up really well, because he's not, because of the limited at bats. 50 bases feels aggressive to me, but I mean, he is the fastest player in baseball, based on speed score at least. I've been learning over the last couple weeks that speed score is not necessarily always a useful metric, but it definitely means that the person can run. And I mentioned it quite a bit in our last podcast, but for those of you who might not be aware, speed score is measuring the number of feet per second on average that a player runs at. With the new advanced metrics that are out there on baseballsavant.com if you want to go and look at that kind of stuff. But I mean, yeah, Buxton has tons of upside. The positive look at his ADP of 52 is, you know, he could be a top 10 player next year if everything panned out. When I was trying to think of a comparison for Byron Buxton, the player who came to mind was Andrew Jones with the U and the W. What do you think of that player comparison, Chuck? Do you think there's that much power there, or do you think it's still a little ways off?
I always struggle with Andrew Jones because I remember Andrew Jones as a really great center fielder and an overall really good hitter when he was young. And I think of him as sort of a power-only guy who really faded early because I believe by the time he was 30, he was already in Japan. But I do understand, obviously, the incredible defense is a comparison for sure. And I think Andrew Jones, without directly saying this, sort of grew into a steroid era. And, you know, he obviously got quite a bit bigger by the time he was 30. It just doesn't look like Byron Buxton is going to get that big. So when you compare him early in his career, I see that kind of potential and that kind of upside. And Andrew Jones certainly had first round style years in production. So I get that part of it. I'm hoping to get a bit more consistency. It would be really nice for fantasy in general if he was more consistent than Andrew Jones was throughout his career, because it seemed like he went back and forth between having a little speed and having a lot of power and not having batting average, etc. So I hope for some more consistency, but to this point, that would seem kind of like a pipe dream, because Byron Buxton has been anything but consistent at this stage. Now, I've seen numerous things about the adjustments that he made last year and us hoping that he holds true to those, the way that he messed around with his leg kick until he could catch up to stuff that they were using to tie him up early in the season. So I think there is that upside, and obviously I'm buying into it. I also play my NFBC league as if it's a lottery, meaning that I will take extra risks. I'm not just trying to compete. I would really like to have an incredible team that does very well in the overall. And I think Byron Buxton is the kind of guy that's why I called him the make or break kind of gamble that he could be. Now, if I'm wrong, what do you consider his floor to be for stolen bases? I'm considering his floor to be around 30, and it sounds like you're not as optimistic as I am.
I think I saw Steamer projecting him at 20 or 30. I'm just going to validate that right now, but I remember seeing something about Buxton being extremely efficient in his stolen base attempts. So I think that makes, you know, 30 probably pretty safe. The only question really that comes with him is he hasn't shown great plate skills as of yet, because he's still striking out 30% of the time and he's only walking 7% of the time. So the only real limiter there is, will he get on base enough to be able to get that many steals? Just for the purpose of noting this, Steamer only projects him at 21.
Well, there's times that I don't necessarily agree with projection systems. And one of the things is, for me, when I look at Buxton last year, I know that he came in as a defensive replacement and as a pinch runner a lot. I don't think his playing time was quite as regular as it might appear. Sometimes games played, you look at games played, you say, oh, well, he played in this many games. Well, that doesn't mean he really played the whole game. That just means he played in those games. So, obviously he struggled mightily at the beginning of the season. So it's crazy to me. I find Byron Buxton to be an outlier in the top five rounds, because it seems to me like he has maybe as much bust potential as any player in the draft, and certainly more bust potential than almost any player drafted before him. Would you agree with that?
I think so. I don't think there's anyone before him that's going to have more bust potential. I think the stolen bases are, I mean, I just commented on this, but I think they are pretty safe. He's stealing 89% of bases in his short MLB career so far. That's pretty impressive. 41-5.
All right, well, let's talk about another outfielder that I have who's going right around the same time in my drafts, and that's Tommy Pham, who was an afterthought going into last year's drafts because we really didn't see a clear path for him having playing time. And now he did play a lot last year, and he played at an incredible level. And obviously the across-the-board production is awfully enticing. But that 368 BABIP, that just sticks out like a sore thumb to me on the Tommy Pham stat line from last year. Where are you on Tommy Pham? And since we just compared the two players, who would you rather have, Pham or Buxton?
I would probably, like, I think I'd rather Pham. And the reason for it is I think he's providing you, like, the batting average has a lot to do with it. The 368 BABIP last year does appear to be an outlier, but his career BABIP is actually 356, so it's actually not that far above. That also being said, I don't think you're going to get more from Tommy Pham this year than you got last year. At his age, I don't think we should expect him to progress further. I don't think he's going to hit you 30 home runs, and he's probably not going to get past 30 steals. But that being said, if you can get a 300 average to go with 20, you know, nearly 100 runs and probably 70 plus RBIs, I think that's pretty good value. I was looking over where he's expected to bat in the Cardinals order. It looks like he's right now being projected to bat second by Roster Resource. Which isn't bad when you consider what the Cardinals are, would you say, the third best offense in the National League Central, Chuck?
You know me, I would definitely say that. But I agree that they're the third best offense, but I do think they need some rebound seasons to be a good offense, meaning Dexter Fowler has been sort of an everywhere and nowhere player throughout his career, if you remember back to when he couldn't play regularly in Colorado the whole time. So I think they need some bounce back from Fowler. They need some bounce back from Carpenter. And they need the fountain of youth to continue offensively for Yadier Molina. So I'm less optimistic. I think that offense has quite a bit less upside, in my opinion, than the Brewers and the Cubs offense has, but I do clearly see them as the third best offense in that division. It's also Marcelo Zuna needs to be Marcelo Zuna of last year, not the one that seemed to be struggling to find it for the 2 years before that as well. So there's variables involved, obviously, as there would be in almost any offense. I mean, the Jed Jorko, Colton Wong platoon at second, which is, you know, being projected right now, is a little scary as well. So there's questions there, and I don't think their offensive upside is as good as the Brewers and the Cubs. Would you agree?
I definitely agree. And I think the only thing that would scare me, the biggest thing that scares me about Pham is the Cardinals' unwillingness to stay with necessarily the same three outfielders year over year. When you consider those players moving up and down because they have so much outfield depth in their prospect levels, that, like, what happens to Tommy Pham if he struggles through the first 20 or 30 games? Is he going to get the Randall Grichuk treatment of welcome to the bench and we're going to bring in somebody else for a little while, or are they going to let him play through it?
Yeah, it seems like a legitimate question. He also started his career so late that I can't quite fathom them getting in rebuild mode, but I could see some things going wrong and them sort of trying to figure out how to shuffle their shuffle the cards a little bit and maybe be able to acquire a pitcher or something at the deadline. Their pitching seems a little woefully thin with Adam Wainwright and with Reyes not projected in their rotation. So they have some bits and pieces going on here. Maybe we'll know more in the coming days when we keep assuming this barrage of free agent signings is going to happen. For what it's worth, I would prefer Buxton. Maybe I'm being an ageist, since Buxton is 24. Does that sound right? I think he's 24 or 25.
Yeah.
Buxton is both awfully young, and I think the 19 home runs last year from Buxton is tantalizing as well. So I find him tantalizing on both. I think he has a legitimate shot to go. I think Buxton has a shot to go 30-50. And if he did that, he would be a first-round pick next year for sure.
Yeah, for sure.
Like, there's no question. I'm just I'm also assuming some maturation here, both in his body and his body type. And I guess that's not always the easiest thing to do. That's overly optimistic, I will grant you. But I don't think it's unrealistic. There's a difference between optimistic and realistic. Okay, let's talk about one more guy that I have going in the first five rounds, and that is Corey Seager. We didn't really talk about this when we talked about draft strategies yet, but one of my favorite draft strategies is to look at guys that used to be significantly higher in ADP than they are now and really delve into why their ADP has fallen. And Corey Seager is a guy who last year you could never see get out of the first half of the second round. I mean, people were really jumping on Corey Seager coming off his Rookie of the Year campaign, etc. I did it again. Coming off his Rookie of the Year campaign. And I wonder if anything legitimate within the skill set of Corey Seager is why we're seeing his ADP fall. Maybe that's just the drafts that I'm in. Well, you are on the ball today, Andrew, as far as being able to tell me what's going on. So where do you have Corey Seager's ADP, and what do you think about Corey Seager as a draft value this year?
Yeah, his ADP is sitting at 40. We'll call it 40, 39.7. I think really the regression in Corey Seager's draft position has less to do with him and more to do with the progression of other shortstops or shortstop eligible players. Because when you look at his profile, you know, he's for shortstop. I mean, overall, he hits for average amount of home runs. He's above average for runs scored. He's going to give you an average amount of RBIs. He's below average for steals, and he's a plus in your average. So for your 5x5, that's four, you know, more or less 4 to 5, at least evens, if not positives, which is great, especially from shortstop, which was once, you know, a barren wasteland of players. But in today's game, when you look at what everyone expects from Carlos Correa, what everyone expects from Francisco Lindor. You throw Alex Bregman into the mix, who I think is a pretty similar outcome to Corey Seager, just with more steals. It starts to slide Seager down a little bit. And that's not even talking about Trey Turner, who, you know, everyone loves to be possibly a 50 or 60 steal guy this year. So I think that's got a lot more to do with it, because a year ago, you know, we weren't as high on Lindor. We weren't as high on Turner. So I think that's got a lot to do with the ADP. Is just he's falling down largely because others have stepped up.
I certainly see that to an extent. I also think that once you get past the first round and a half, I think people really start to think about stolen bases. And surprisingly enough, Seager appears to be one of those guys who has good baseball quickness, but not good stolen base potential. I think of some other players from the past, and these players are not really fantasy equivalents per se. But I think of, you know, J.J. Hardy was a guy who was a really good defender, and you assumed that he had to be able to run some, and that was just never going to happen. And Seager has not shown a penchant for running at all, and I think that's getting him nudged down a little bit within the actual draft context itself. Not that he's really falling below a lot of shortstops purely because of that reason, but because you have people starting to think that they need to get some balance. If you took Arenado and you're not going to get any speed from him, you took Manny Machado, you're not going to get any speed from him, you took Bryce Harper and you have no idea what speed you're going to get from him. Now, I took Bryce Harper, the first thing I thought is, am I going to get 3 steals, 15 or 20? I don't have any idea. And so some of that uncertainty, I think, starts to play in and nudge him down a little bit further than I think he should go. It is curious that he has struggled as far as RBIs are concerned, batting towards the top of a National League lineup, which is always a possibility. So I just want to I want to talk now about how much you feel
One last thing before we move off Seager. How much are you concerned about his back issues at the end of last year? I mean, I'm seeing reports that his back's fine and, you know, no one should be worried about it. But a back injury for a shortstop who spends a lot of time being hunched over seems like something that is being fluffed off as not much of a concern.
I think some of that is mitigated by ageism. Again, I think you tend to believe that younger guys are going to bounce back a lot quicker than older guys, which we could have talked about the opposite extreme, which is Daniel Murphy, and talked about exactly, you know, how he's still going in the top five rounds, but we're taking a leap of faith on his knee injury. So I think recovery is generally considered to be a more likely thing from younger players, and to the best of my knowledge, Seager was playing all the way to the end of the year last year, so I think that has mitigated some of the fear as well. So it's just, I don't think anyone thinks that Corey Seager has had his best year yet by any means, but in a way it's comparative to Chris Bryant. Okay, Chris Bryant, everyone saw all this incredible amount of upside in. Well, in his second year, that upside didn't happen. And now he's getting moved down maybe 8 or 10 picks, whereas Corey Seager's second year didn't develop. He didn't take that next step right away, which we are impatient in the fantasy world. And now all of a sudden you see Corey Seager's dropping off 20 to 25 picks over where he was going last year. So I do find that odd, and that's just, I just wanted to mention that that's why I put him on the list. So when I come up with these concepts, Andrew, I try to, you know, tie in players to the concepts, and sometimes it's going to be kind of cryptic as to why the players were listed. Like, you might not have really known why Corey Seager was on the list, but I do think Corey Seager is going to have a breakout year in the next 2 or 3 years, and if it's this year, people who get him around pick 40 are going to get one heck of a value. Do you agree with that?
Absolutely. Yeah.
He plays in a really, on a really good offense, a team that's really been productive offensively. So this is an interesting situation for sure to monitor going forward as to how his draft value plays out. Now let's talk about drafting between rounds 5 and rounds 10, 6 and 10, if you will. But do you see a big difference once you get past the top 5 rounds in what you're thinking about, in what you're balancing in your head between rounds 6 and 10 than you did between rounds 1 and 5?
Yes and no. I'm still going to say, you know, let's stick to the game plan. But once you hit round 6 through 10, I think it's more of a spot where you're starting to fill in the gaps. You know, you need to retrospectively look at what you did in the first 5, and then it's, okay, do I need power? Okay, who's available to me that has power, that's, you know, a surplus of power that's not hurting me in too many other spots? Same thing with speed, if there's anything left. But I think you're starting to look at positional. For me, I'm looking at positional eligibility more at that point and saying, you know, do I need pitchers? Do I need outfielders? So for me, that's how I'm thinking about round 6 through 10.
Yeah, it's an interesting landscape between 6 and 10. I think the first factor for me is how I feel like my starting pitching staff is developing as to how much I need to focus between round 6 and 10. And you're already getting to the start of what I've heard on other podcasts called the glob of starting pitchers. So you do not know exactly how much of a difference you're getting from some of the pitchers between round 6 and 10 than you would be getting from a pitcher 2 or 3 rounds later. But it's the flavor that you prefer. It is kind of, it turns into pick your flavor pretty fast outside of the top 20 pitchers. Do you agree with that synopsis? And do you see that as an important factor as to what you do between round 6 and 10?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, with the interesting thing about the quote-unquote glob of starting pitching in that area is that personally, it's not a lot of guys that I like. When I'm thinking about guys going between pick 75 and 150, like, we're talking about, you know, Dallas Keuchel and John Lester and Jeff Samardzija and David Price, Marcus Stroman, you know, Masahiro Tanaka, Sonny Gray, Trevor Bauer. Like, most of these guys I'm staying away from outside of Trevor Bauer. Like, I would in some ways almost prefer to wait further on pitching in that space, because I'd rather try the upside of Jameson Taillon at 196 or roll the humidor dice on Taiwan Walker to see at 220, just to see, because I think the upside is pretty similar on those guys, and if not actually a little bit better. So I guess that's just how I see it for the that glob of starting pitchers.
Yeah, it's tricky because the bigger the league, the more you can get caught outside of a run of starting pitchers. And again, I'll use the context of one of my drafts. I had the league that I'm picking 12th in. We had a run in the fourth round of 9 starting pitchers taken in 11 picks.
Ouch.
And that was a league where I didn't have a pitcher yet. So I took Yu Darvish there because I liked him so much more than the rest of the starting pitchers, which I really hate to play into a run like that, and I thought about not doing it. But it got to the point where the run was so extreme that I felt like, without being able to pick up free agents in a 15-team draft, that I couldn't go any deeper with who I thought was quote-unquote my number one pitcher. So, and Chris Archer went in the pick after me, which I prefer Yu Darvish by miles being in Chicago for the entire season over Chris Archer in whatever that debacle is that's going on in Tampa Bay. You agree with me?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I don't want to call the Rays trash, but at the same time, like, how many wins do you think you're going to get from Chris Archer this year? Can you get more than 10? I'm not guaranteeing that. Where with Darvish, it would be easy to project 15 if he stays healthy, if not upwards of 20.
Yeah, and the strikeout upside is pretty much identical.
Yeah,
and Darvish, I think, seems to have a bit of a chip on his shoulder in social media that he's been so harshly judged from his World Series performance. So I feel like there's some bounce back potential there as well. But like I said, that's part of the reason that the bigger the drafts, I'm in an 18-team draft now, a head-to-head draft. I believe you're in that draft too, aren't you, Andrew?
No, I'm in the 19-team Roto League draft.
But in the 18-team draft, you can imagine as well that there's going to have to be some forecasting of runs and trying to avoid being trapped in certain areas of production when it comes to categories or in certain positions. So I'm in pretty close agreement with you about the slight nuances of picking your second 5 picks versus your first 5 picks. Now, I wanted to point out some players in those second 5 picks that I thought were pretty interesting case studies for various reasons. The first person that I want to look at is Marcus Stroman. And I'm doing that because we haven't covered a pitcher yet, in detail anyway. And the pitching of Marcus Stroman has been sort of mysterious. He was obviously highly touted after a strong rookie campaign, and he struggled some with injuries. And I just find it very odd that a pitcher with Stroman's line, talking about a guy who really struggles with his K per 9 and had a 1.31 whip and pitches in the American League East, can go between rounds 6 and 10. I think that's frightening, even given the fact that his arsenal does have the optimal situation of producing a ton of ground balls.
Yeah, the reasoning, I think, behind this 125 ADP is he's over a 60% ground ball rate over the last 3 years. What's encouraging is that he had a 10% swinging strike rate last year. What's discouraging about that is it doesn't look like it affected his K per 9. So I think he was only at like a 7.6 in his K per 9, which is It's okay, but I don't think that's. But I think there's almost no strikeout upside there. And I saw some video on Twitter earlier in the week where I believe it was Vlad Sedler was talking about Marcus Stroman and saying, you know, if you take him as the 20th best starting pitcher, there is no chance that he finishes better than the 20th starting pitcher at the end of the year. There's a better chance that he ends up falling down to being the 30th or 40th starting pitcher. And I think there's a lot of truth in that. I don't know how good the Blue Jays are going to be. And they're definitely in a position where if they struggle early, they will probably go into full sale. Like they could be in the same fire sale type situation that the Rays are, because Donaldson's in his last year of his contract. And, you know, after Donaldson, there's not any true star talent sitting on this roster anywhere. So you're into rebuild at that point, because no one else on this team is going to be carrying you without seeing some, you know, significant jump from like an Anthony Alford or something becoming a superstar, which no one is expecting. So I think at that point, if things start going downhill for the Blue Jays, that they're going to probably start selling the farm and waiting for Bo Bichette and Vlad Guerrero Jr. to make their way up.
Yeah, he just sticks out like a sore thumb to me. And he's also somebody that you have to pair with the right kind of pitcher with that 1.31 whip. Like, it scared me to death to end up with Stroman and Darvish. Darvish, a guy who's struggled, you know, with his 8 or 9 or 24 pitch arsenal, whatever they're calling it these days. But he's struggled at times with his control. And it freaks those variables that I mentioned about Stroman freak me out where he's going. And I do wish Justin was on with us today, because he is a Marcus Stroman guy, far more than I am, for sure. Okay, let's talk about a completely different position, and this sort of epitomizes the struggle that we have at catcher this year. And let's talk about Salvador Perez. He's been an iron man, and he really had a productive season last year. He has a tendency to be really good through the first three quarters of the season and then wear down a little bit. But Sal Perez brings a couple of different things to the table here. Number one, catching is ridiculously weak. And number two, the Kansas City Royals lineup is obnoxiously weak. You see projections of Hunter Dozier playing regularly for them. You see Jorge Bonifacio in the middle of their lineup. I mean, it just doesn't even sound right to begin with. And so the question becomes, which factors here do you see that push Salvador Perez to somewhere between the end of the 10th round to outside of the 10th round? And do you think he's a value where he's going?
For me, he's not. I love that he's hit 20 or more home runs in the last 3 years. But one thing is that he played less than 150 games for the first time last year, and I think he battled some injuries a little bit. So I think that's a bit of a concern when you look at his overall workload over the last 5 years. And if you're playing an OBP format, I don't think he's any better than, you know, the guy, probably the 10th best catcher on the board when you start to weigh things out, because he takes a walk 3% of the time. You pair that with a .250 batting average, and you're not getting a lot of help there from Sal Perez. 3.6% career walk rate. So getting him in right around the first 100 picks doesn't feel like good strategy to me. Because I think there's more valuable players to you on the board at that point. Because he's not doing anything special for you other than, you know, hopefully providing you above average catcher stats at that point.
I've seen catcher rankings that have him in front of JT Realmuto, and that just absolutely floors me. I realize that, you know, the Marlins situation is not pretty, and he seems to be disgruntled. But he can also run. He can also hit for average. He's JT Realmuto can, and he has some power upside. And I think he ends up hitting in the middle of that lineup as well. So I don't see the downside of Realmuto compared to Salvador Perez. And both these cases, the team context is important in so much as catchers have very limited upside when it comes to scoring runs and RBIs. As a generality, most of them hang out towards the bottom of the lineups. That's what the difference is between that very upper tier of catchers and everyone else. And it just stuns me that that people could be hoping for more than 65 RBIs. Really wouldn't be bad for either of these guys in the lineups that they're looking to play in for the entirety of the year. So I wanted to include Perez here because I wanted to talk a little catcher strategy. And it sounds like if Andrew Dewhurst doesn't get one of the top guys, he's willing to wait. Are you forcibly making sure to get one of the top four or five guys, or what is your game plan?
I'm not. I think I'm going to be somebody who waits. I mean, through my draft so far, I got Buster Posey in the 19 team staff roto league, and that's just because I didn't want to have the 19th worst catcher. Because and when you consider the at bats, I think there's a big plus there. Although one thing I do think, I don't think I've necessarily had considered before right now with Salvador Perez, is could he spend a significant amount of the year as a DH? Because if he does, I think that does a lot for his value. Because while I agree the lineup isn't fantastic by any means, Roster Resource has him batting fourth though. So I would think that if he's going to bat in the four hole for you, you're going to want him to probably play 150 games from that spot instead of potentially moving up a Jorge Soler or a Chesler Cuthbert, right? Those aren't exactly scary middle of the order bats. But when Alex Gordon's batting third, I don't know what to say.
The whole thing sounds pretty silly, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Especially considering how recent their success was. So I wanted to bring up both the team context a little bit, and I wanted to talk about catcher, and we accomplished that. Now let's talk about a different run entirely. I am sort of trying to cover the gamut here. And let's talk about Alex Colome and how you feel about him roughly going as top 10 to 14 closer off the board, which puts him in the top 10 rounds of NFBC style drafts for sure, the 15 teamers and the 18 team and 19 team leagues that we're talking about at the moment. Alex Colome is a guy that recent actions going on in Tampa have to concern you a little bit. And the metrics really didn't like where he was going as a pitcher last year either. So you get sort of a double whammy going here. And you can go as far as a triple whammy when you consider that if he is pitching well, you have to think that he gets traded. And you don't really foresee Alex Colome being a guy that's going to get traded to be the closer on an ultra-competitive team either. So I'm curious as to what your thoughts are on Alex Colome and where he's going in drafts so far.
Well, I think of Alex Colome in this sense. Do you think he's the 7.6 K per nine guy, or do you think he's the 11.6 K per nine guy? Personally, I think he's the 7.6 guy. That's what he's done two of the last 3 years. I think that's most likely to be who he is. And that means I'm heading for the hills. There is no way I'm drafting a catcher a closer at, around 120 with that kind of profile. Because he doesn't offer you the multiple innings that you might get from a Raisel Iglesias or a Brad Hand, which are two other pitchers who, also are going to be pitching for suboptimal teams. So I think I would rather wait. And try my hand at, maybe Sean Doolittle a little bit later. Brad Boxberger at 323, if you want to roll the dice on, if he's going to be the starter or the full-time closer or not. I just don't think there's a lot of upside on Colome. He was projected for 30 saves. I don't see him getting that number right now, because I think that would ultimately mean he would have to save about 50% of all of the Rays' wins, which is a little bit harsh and dramatic. But I think you can see the point there. So Colum is just not a guy that I'm in on this year.
Well, I always go back to this mantra of mine. I hear a lot of people say that it doesn't really matter the quality of the team for saves, totals. And to an extent, that is true. But I also know one thing. No one gets a save in a game they lose. That much I know for certain. I mean, no matter what. You know, if a team wins, you can find cases of teams winning 90 ball games where their main closer only saved 26 games or so, 26 to 30, say. You can find extremes. Roberto Hernandez years ago as a Ray, a Devil Ray then, is the extremist example of teams that win very few games, but almost all their games are save opportunities. But I think the truth of it usually is somewhere in the middle. And if I think two closers are very similar in stuff, in security, and what have you, then I'm going to go with the team that I think is better. Because to me, more wins means more save possibilities. It doesn't mean more save opportunities. I get that. But it means more save possibilities because you can't save a game that your team did not win under any circumstances. It can't conceivably happen. So, and that's my sort of my reactionary take on saves in general. And I thought, originally, I thought going into the year that Colum was going to be a little undervalued. I own him in the three-sport league, which we drafted 13 months ago, because I thought there was some safety, and I was foreseeing the Rays as sticking with what they've done in recent years, which is going for it with what they have. It has been a pattern for years. Well, now it's very obvious that they're not going for it anymore by any stretch of the imagination. So it's going to create a much different landscape for them this year. And I think that you're going to see Alex Colomé's ADP fall from here on out. All right, let's talk about one more player, and I'm just curious because I think he's going outside the top 10 rounds, and he's been pointed to as a potential draft value, and ageism comes in again, and that would be one Ian Kinsler, who goes to a relatively balanced lineup now in Anaheim, and a certain upgrade in environment overall, over where he played in Detroit last year. And I see the potential for Ian Kinsler to have some across-the-board production as long as he can stay on the field. I wonder what you think about Ian Kinsler as a post-top 10-round kind of guy.
I love Ian Kinsler there. I think when I dove into his numbers, a lot of his production last year was hindered by first injuries, but second, he had a 244 BABIP last year. That's way below what he'd done in previous years. So I think but the rest of his profile matches almost identical to the last two from the year prior when he was a huge value for those who drafted him. So when you look at that ADP of 192, he's going to lead off on what looks to be a significantly better Angels lineup than it's been certainly in the past few years. So I think there's a lot of reason to be buying into Ian Kinsler at this point. And 192 is a fantastic spot. I think there'd be a lot of cases where I would maybe even be willing to draft him 40 or 50 spots higher than that.
Yeah, I hear... And we're covering a lot of different things within this concept, which is okay, and I like it. But I hear a lot of anti-Angels. I hear a lot of pessimism towards the Angels lineup. And I think people are saying, well, what if Andrelton Simmons just really isn't a very good offensive player? What if Zach Cozart is supposedly terrible outside of Cincinnati, even though he wasn't terrible outside of Cincinnati last year? And what if he doesn't play but 75 or 80 games? And what if Ian Kinsler is just too old? And, you know, the what-ifs just keep flying around. But that offense has gotten significantly better, and all of those things are not necessarily true. And even if two of the three of them turn out to be false, you're going to see a pretty significant upgrade in that lineup in general. And Kinsler is wildly undervalued at his draft position right now. And he's going at the end of the second baseman that are, you can start with confidence. And so I feel like his upside is amazing. And I think he should be going in the top 10 rounds, somewhere between, you know, late in the ninth and the middle of the 10th round. And instead he's going well after that, which makes very little sense to me at this point. So I just wanted to bring him up as somebody in opposition to what we've seen. I mean, you see a lot of people that we talked about earlier are people that the situation is getting worse around them. I don't understand how anyone could look at where Kinsler was last year with the Tigers and not think that the situation is significantly upgraded, having Mike Trout and Andrelton Simmons and Zach Cozart and, you know, Cowboy Calhoun, whoever
Justin
you want to look
Upton.
At. Justin Upton. I mean, I didn't even bring up Upton at this point. I mean, so I find him to be one of the oddest people to be outside of the top 10 rounds because I despise second base late. When you get to second base late, you end up looking at Josh Harrison and guys like that that you don't really have a good idea what you're getting from, and you don't like their necessary landing spots before the year is done. You know, Neil Walker is a guy that we don't spend any time talking about, but if Neil Walker was on the second base list, you'd feel a little bit better about the very bottom end of second base. And now we don't know if he's going to start the season on a team or not, so there's some uncertainty there. So you know, I think you're looking at a more top-heavy position in second base than you might realize until you start drafting. And so I would be cautious when it comes to second base, and I would be aggressive when it comes to Ian Kinsler, which it sounds like Andrew Dewhurst could not be more in agreement with me on that point. Well, Andrew, considering we had to makeshift around some illness from Justin and some rough scheduling, I really appreciate you coming through and hitting a home run like you do every week, sir. Why don't you tell us things you're working on in particular right now and tell us when you can be reached. I'll do the same and we can get out of here.
Sure. Working on making my way through multiple slow drafts without losing my mind. Probably first and foremost right now. Got a weekly hockey article coming out. If you're playing fantasy hockey, you can check that out, along with a weekly podcast. Doing this show with you every week, and I'll probably start to drop more written baseball content in the next, probably by opening day, hopefully, once the fantasy hockey season has started to wind down.
Yep, and I'm staying as busy as I could possibly imagine with fantasy right now. This is kind of feels like writing this concept show, which is okay. I've spent a lot of time. I was an English major in college, so I spent a lot of time trying to throw around concepts and getting stuff that I would be willing to write about, or in this case, a concept that I think is worth expounding on. And I just wanted people to think ahead of their drafts this week and think, what am I going to be thinking about for the first portion of the draft, and what am I going to be thinking about as the draft transitions, as the player values drop once you get outside of the top 100 or so players. So I want to thank everyone. I'm Chuck Anderson. I can be reached at Just Chucking It on Twitter. Thanks to everyone for staying with FWFB. We provide a ton of great content. Our staff continues to grow, and hopefully we will be able to keep you on board throughout the entire season, not just the draft season. Thanks so much for listening to an FWFB concept podcast a la Dr. Andrew Dewhurst.